that. So this is the Zen practice of treating each thing as if it is Buddha. So this is an aspect of Zen practice that I'm not sure that I've gotten across so well sometimes. One of the words for this practice, I had heard this word before, but I didn't realize it really was referring to this, is nyoho. This is a Japanese word. Nyo meaning being in accord with, and ho being a word for the Dharma or truth. So nyoho is being in accord with the Dharma or truth. And what it really refers to in the monastic tradition is being in accord in a very physical, practical, day-to-day way. So it refers to the colors, materials, and size as they relate to food, how it's prepared, how it's served, how it's received, clothing, meaning, you know, monastic robes and whatever, and shelter. And the point that I want to make tonight is that I'm going to be talking a lot about the way this is manifested in the tradition through Zen monastic practice, particularly Soto Zen monastic practice, but that this is a lovely practice that you can really adapt to lay life and whatever life. The principles can be applied in any of our lives. So when I first encountered this practice, Zen, I was just really struck. I went to Dharmarain over on the east side, and I just kind of, you know, you get this whole, when you're brand new to it, this whole like Zen experience thing, you know, it's the words, it's the robes, it's teachers, it's, I don't know, how everything is done. And I was just struck by how, you know, my teachers and the seniors and the people there just took care with everything. You know, you're supposed to put your shoes straight when you came in the door and line them up on the shelf or along the wall. At meals, the meals were eaten in silence. We didn't do orioki at the time. That's a really elaborate version of this, but we sat silently eating our oatmeal, you know, drinking our tea and just focusing on this stuff. You never poured wastewater down the drain. If it was water that you had washed vegetables in or water out of a vase or something like that, you went outside and you poured it on a plant. Everything was done very thoughtfully. And my teacher similarly took care with each thing, and she was often in charge of cooking in the kitchen. And so it's a pretty typical experience at a Zen center or residence where you're cooking, that you'll have this experience of having to kind of salvage kind of wilty vegetables, you know, like that ordinarily you might at home just be like, eh, you know, go out and get some fresh stuff, but now you know you've got to pick through the lettuce and try to salvage what's okay. And so that, you know, nothing was wasted, and then, you know, whatever parts you didn't eat, you put in the compost. And then one of the really, you know, most memorable touching things was seeing my teacher doing funerals for mice. So we had, you know, cooked a lot, so there's lots of flour, lots of, you know, food stuffs that mice could get into. So at some point there was just, you know, no way around, you know, protecting human health and the resources of the temple, and we'd have to put out mouse traps. But when we caught a mouse, then take the mouse outside, and my teacher would put on her robe and go out and dig it a little grave, and then she'd have a piece of incense, and there's this little animal funeral that you do, and you look at the creature and you give it a name and you say, you know, because of karma, you were born in this present body, you know, discard this body quickly and enter the world of emptiness, and you say this little prayer and bury it. And I was just, you know, previously in my life, when I encountered things, or decided whether how I was going to do something. It was really primarily about what is this thing going to do for me or bring me? Is it valuable? Is it expensive? Will it bring pleasure? Or if I'm going to do something, if I'm going to bother to do something, will anyone notice? Will it make any difference? Or will I enjoy it? I mean, there's a just kind of a calculation. Is this thing, is this being in front of me, is this task, this opportunity, kind of, is it worth my time? How much of my effort and attention is it worth? And this was something, so this Zen approach, it was very, very different. So I'm just going to read a brief couple paragraphs. This is from a book by Paula Arai about a women's training monastery in Japan called the Nisodo. And it's known for its very, very classic, traditional, strict training in the Soto Zen tradition. And she says, according to the Vinaya Pitaka, so that's the monastic regulations from the Buddha's time, monastic discipline is an expression of the Dharma. In Zen parlance, disciplined activity is Buddha activity. Dogen used the phrase, practice is enlightenment. In other words, undisciplined activity is activity that expresses one's ignorance of the reality that all is interrelated and impermanent. Senior nun teachers frequently allude to this teaching and remind novices that delusion about reality leads to acting as if the self is the center. This delusion results in acts of passion and hatred of mind and body. Ugliness is manifested in such acts as waste, disrespect, laziness, and selfishness. Ugliness appears when the Dharma is not manifest in action. On the contrary, beauty appears when the Dharma is manifest in action. In activities from cutting carrots to making offerings on an altar, the nun's monastic training inculcates the notion that discipline is action of the mind and body that is not centered on the self. Novices learn through experience that without delusion about self, hatred and passion do not arise. Each activity is designed to prove that the wisdom of interrelatedness and impermanence results in acts of compassion. But such fancy words are not heard around the monastery, as often as their concrete expressions like, do not be wasteful, and treat all things with respect. And it became obvious to me that the meaning of Buddha activity was encoded in the details of the monastic structure, ritual activity, and procedures for daily tasks. By training in the monastery, then, one can practice Buddha activity. The Zen nuns follow Dogen's mode of Buddhist monasticism that stresses somatic knowledge, which is consistent with his non-dualistic worldview. Intellectual knowledge requires establishing a subject and object dichotomy. The nuns are keenly aware that intellectual forms of knowledge do not necessarily change one's actions in accordance with the cognition of the intellect. They believe that training the body is an expedient method for dissolving a bifurcation of mind and body. For in teaching that body how to act, one is less prone to dichotomize between subject and object. The nuns' practice of Dogen's teachings and regulations illustrates their belief that perfecting the form of an action is an effective way to experience the non-dualistic world where practice is enlightenment. And one of the things that I wanted to include, I remember to include in this was she said sometimes the senior nuns will be teaching younger nuns. They'll do it in kind of funny ways where if, like, they kind of just toss a zafu, the one of these seated, you know, round cushions, then senior nun will go, ow! You know, that's the Buddha, ow! So this in her book, she describes all these ways that, you know, this in this monastic practice, which is still alive to this day, and that we echo in our own forms in the Zen Center, and especially when we're in session in a meditation retreat. There's just, I mean, they just take it to this beautiful art form. It's so. I was at Tassajara Zen Monastery in California for a while, and there was a Japanese nun there. And there's this procedure with which you wash the floors by, like, you know, pushing a rag along the floor, running and pushing this rag, and it's kind of a tricky thing to do. But, you know, there's a way that you rinse the rag, and then there's a particular way that you wring it out. You know, there's a way to wring it out properly. And I was just kind of doing the expedient thing. And she just came and just showed me in this way that communicated not, you're doing it wrong, I have a more efficient way to do it. It was like she was sharing with me this joyous thing that she had learned. Like, you know, fuck. And then it was like, oh, cool. You know, that's so much more effective. Wow. So this way of doing things is, you know, it's this spirit of everything we do matters, everything we encounter matters, every object matters, and certainly then every person that we encounter matters. And in order to pay attention like this, we have to set aside self-absorption and selfishness as we take care. So a lot of these forms, Paulo Arai describes, aren't just arbitrary. They're also set up to make you aware of your own space, aware of what you're leaving behind, aware of your impact on other people. So it's also becoming kind of more socially aware, as well as, you know, taking care of objects. So, you know, one example is there's all these subtleties to it, which there's places where you put something, you know, that's the most convenient spot. And if you claim the most convenient spot, now somebody else can't have that most convenient spot. So one of the things that's always done is, like, if you are brand new to the monastery, it always goes in order of seniority, you'd put your shoes nice and far away from the door. And then you always leave the space next to the door for the teacher's shoes. Just out of this. And, you know, this isn't a matter of, like, you should. There's some kind of guilt-laden thing. We have these strict rules. But just as a practice to become more aware of these things and pay attention, it's just, I find it deeply touching. Another example of something that I just was really struck by was when we do these formal meals and we eat all at the same time, the timing of the meal, we're all eating silently, and if we have orioki, we have all these bowls that we're using. The timing of the main teacher, one of the teachers, is leading the meal. So everything's kind of timed off of them. When they're done eating, you know, they'll kind of, all right, now the meal is over, and there's a closing chant and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that I learned at a training is, here's the, you know, abbot or abbess eating, and you're not looking around, or, you know, not obviously. And the abbess times her own eating so that she ends just before the last person. So she's not rushing everybody, but she's also not, you know, she's also just not necessarily going with the slowest person. So, you know, there's a little bit. So it's just this kind of gentle consideration, which means, you know, if you're doing this, you need to be aware of everybody else in the room. need to be aware of how other people are doing and their timing. And I don't know. I mean, this is a practice that is done, it's kind of just like the precepts. I don't think anybody can claim to be perfect at this by any means, but it's in a way, we're just as informed by the practice when we realize we're not doing Nyoho, we're not acting in accord with the Dharma as when we are. So Paula Arai's book was actually full of stories of how hard it is to train in a strict monastery like that, and how people bug each other to no end and get really irritated, and how, as opposed to, you know, this beautiful manifestation of the Dharma, these same things can communicate, you know, irritation and judgment, like, you know, these same small, like tossing and turning in your bed kind of loud because the person, you know, the person next to you can't rest, or just, and you watch sometimes, like, at a retreat, the way people are eating their orioki, it just reflects their state of mind. So it, obviously, it's actually even kind of sweet. I mean, somebody, you know, it's like the third day, they're in pain, they're fed up, there's their bowl, and they're just like, I mean, it's just, you know, the resistance is just coming out and everything. And that, but then, of course, there are those of us who are just like, look how precious, I'm doing everything, whole line, you know, it's, our practice is manifested in the way that we move, but also affected by the way that we move and what we do. So there's awareness of others, our impacts on them. Obviously, this is a mindfulness practice. This is paying attention. It's cultivating gratitude. Another aspect of the women's training is using a particular verb conjugation form in Japanese called keigo, which is, it's a honorific thing, and I wish I had the book, but she says essentially, it sounds really awkward in English, but essentially, you know, you're if you were going up a flight of stairs with a load and somebody says, what are you doing? You could answer saying, I am so grateful that I, you know, my legs are strong and I am vital and I can carry this load up the stairs for, you know, the sake of others, or, I mean, which sounds, you know, it sounds really awkward in English, but apparently just through the verb conjugations, they can get this across. And that they also will use the word o before things to say, kind of, it's like an honorific kind of thing. Like the robe that I wear is a kesa, K-E-S-A, and typically we say o kesa, just it's a, but then you can say o anything. Oh, teacup, oh, you know, and just making that extra gesture of appreciation. So this practice, which, you know, if we try to get across in the Zendo and at our sessions and stuff like that, I have heard on more than one occasion that this comes off as simply being anal, that, you know, needing this to be clean and noticing there's some dust on the altar and wanting the rose to be straight, you know, and having Bob come in and measure and put black painter's tape down so that, you know, we can align the zabutons up, and when they're lined up properly, you can't see the tape. And, you know, it sounds anal. And it could be, I suppose, if you're just being irritable about it. And yet, you know, when I'm doing it, when I'm wanting things to be neatly arranged, there's an aspect of gratitude. When we leave our meditation seat and we turn back to it and we brush it off, and there's a way to plump up a zafu, you kind of push on the edges to fluff it up, and you put it right in the middle, and then you take the little chant card and you put it right on top, and you bow to your seat, and you bow away from your seat. So there's that kind of acknowledgement, like, I had this opportunity to sit, here was this safe, supportive place for me to sit. And you may never return to that seat. you may die tomorrow, and now the seat will be ready for the next person. You know, when somebody, the first time that they walk into this zendo and they see everything, they may not even be conscious of, like, I would be conscious myself, but, you know, not everybody would be. But there's still going to be a sense of just kind of balance and care and cleanliness and whatever that, the, you know, when this is their first impression of the Dharma, what is that impression going to be? And it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, it needs to be balanced, because if you get too much of this stuff going on, people just end up feeling uptight and like, uh-oh, I better get it right. So we want to hold it as a practice that we can be generous with, but it's not just about me. It goes back a long, long way. So Dogen, you know, as many of you know, he was in the 1200s in Japan, and he has some beautiful expressions of how in our practice, and again, this is describing monastic practice, but this is something that we can bring about into our, easily into our daily lives. So one of my favorites of his, of course, is the instructions for the tenzo, for the cook. So he describes very carefully. Now, the cook is a very important person in the monastery, but we're not... I don't think that came naturally. I think this was, you know, because of the practice, because of exactly what we're talking about, of making everything practice. That's why it was acknowledged what an opportunity it was to be tenzo and how important that role was. Not, if you think about it, most of the time, oh, you're just the cook. That's not a high status thing. But there's a whole chapter on what the tenzo should do. And the tenzo's basically got to work, I don't know, like 16 hours a day, according to Dogen, plan everything, oversee everything. And he says, when you wash rice and prepare vegetables, you must do it with your own hands and with your own eyes, making sincere effort. Because he had seen many instances where somebody's supposedly the head cook and they just delegate everything. And then they go read sutras or sit in the zendo. Do not be idle even for a moment. Do not be careful about one thing and careless about another. Do not give away your opportunity, even if it is merely a drop in the ocean of merit. Do not fail to place even a single particle of earth at the summit of the mountain of wholesome deeds. When preparing the vegetables and the soup ingredients to be cooked, do not discuss the quantity or quality of these materials, which have been obtained from the monastery officers. Just prepare them with sincerity. Most of all, you should avoid getting upset or complaining about the quantity of food materials. You should practice in such a way that things come and abide in your mind, and your mind returns and abides in all things all through the day and night. As tenzo, you should not be away from the sink when the rice for the noon meal is being washed. Watch closely with clear eyes. Do not waste even one grain. I don't know if you've washed rice before, but not losing even one grain is pretty difficult. When you boil rice, know that the water is your own life. At some point here, he talks about treating the materials, the food, as if it's your own eyes. You know, if you were washing and preparing, and these were your own eyes, how carefully you would handle them. So I kind of appreciate the fact that he makes this so extreme, because it makes it pretty obvious, like, we can never actually literally fulfill this ideal. And yet, when we keep it in mind, so Dogen kind of brought and revitalized a lot of these monastic regulations in Japan in the 1200s. But the oldest, like the Buddhist monastic regulations, go way further back than that. So there's an extant version of the monastic regulations from 1103. which means they were fully evolved, so it meant, you know, it was a lot older than that. So the Chanyuan Qingui is that oldest text, and it also has instructions for the Tenzo. The cook is in charge of all the assembly's meals. He must exercise his mind with Tao and must always vary the menu so that everyone will receive enjoyment. He should not waste monastery food. He should make sure there is no disorder in the kitchen. In selecting his kitchen help, he should choose people who are capable and assign them to appropriate positions. His orders should not be so severe as to oppress his assistants, and yet not so lax that they will not fulfill their duties. So it gets very specific about how you treat the cookware and all that kind of stuff. And then, this might be new to some of you, in the Chanyuan Qingui and in Dogen, there are very explicit instructions for washing your face and going to the toilet. So there's a whole section in here about how you will go going to the toilet. If a monk needs to use the toilet, he should do so in good time and not wait until the last moment, allowing internal pressures to compel unseemly haste. He should first fold his kesa and place it on his desk or on a particular pole and bow before leaving. So it goes through this whole process of how the monk kind of removes layers of robes and gets them out of the way. He carries the water vessel with his right hand, and entering the latrine, removes his shoes and lays them side by side. He softly pulls the door to close it. Before relieving himself, he should snap his fingers 3 times to warn the ghosts who feed on excrement. I don't know if that's like it's coming or come get it. I don't know. He should not be dirty with mucus or spit scattering it about, and he should not make excessive noise. He should not use the bamboo spatulas to draw on the floor, door, or walls, and he should not talk or make jokes with the people next door. Very specific. And then I thought this would be sweet to see, though this is a very recent, like, this is put out by the Sotoshu, practices at a Zen monastery. And so this is kind of the modern version of how it's kind of actually done. Very explicit instructions for bedtime, how you lay down if you are sleeping in this communal training hall. And it's very sweet also, they have all kinds of verses or gathas that they say at different significant times, which this is another aspect that can be really easily incorporated into daily life, in a lay life. So they all bow together at once when the evening bell rings and chant the verse of sleep. As we go to sleep this night, may all sentient beings calm all things, making the mind clear and untainted. And then there's a particular formal sleeping posture, and when you're sleeping in the Zendo, you don't aim your feet at the image on the altar. They have the washing of the face and how you tie up your robes. And this is the when you're using your toothbrush, you recite, presumably before or after, holding the toothbrush, may all living beings attain the true Dharma and be naturally pure and clean. When we rinsing the mouth, may all living beings approach the pure Dharma gate and accomplish liberation. So it goes on from there. So in terms of making this practice part of our lives, part of our, you know, our temple and on our lay lives, I mean, certainly this is something that we can actually do at our temple, that we can be, you know, focus especially on this. When we come in, our door tends to slam unless you are mindful of it and, you know, kind of hold it and keep it from doing that. So that's an opportunity. That is a mindfulness opportunity. People may be sitting in here already and there's a slam. So, you know, I mean, it can be hard. Maybe you forget it first. And you can let the door close softly. Then you can come in, you know, hang up your coat, put your shoes neatly lined up, even if it's only a few shoes, you know, your shoes side by side. And then at that moment, as you're putting your shoes down, you know, there's a moment of gratitude. I mean, how often do you look at your shoes? It's like, eh. But for a moment, we're grateful for that. Grateful for this opportunity. Grateful to you know, blend in with others. Look at all these people that are already here. I'll add my shoes to the line. And it's just such a, if you ever walk into a Zen situation and you see all those little shoes lined up, it's just, I don't know. It does my heart good. When you come in, we often don't do this, but because this room is multi-purpose, but coming in, you know, bowing when you come in to the Zendo. Like I said, bowing to your seat when you get to it, bowing away from it. When we care for the space. I mean, some people come in and clean regularly, but that doesn't mean at any time we can't look around and notice that there's, you know, lint or dust or something like that that we can clean up and help make things tidy. So in practices at home, we have these gathas, there's personal rituals. Like when I learned about Orioki, I got myself a set of 3 nesting bowls and, you know, 8 out of them just as a mindfulness practice. We can hold things with both hands. That's a very sweet practice that you never just kind of, you know, toss something, that you move it carefully. Keeping things clean. Being gentle and quiet with dishes and pots. It's a very interesting one. I was at Tassajara Zen Monastery, actually, and a friend of mine, he worked in the kitchen. I think he was like a chef as well. And I mean, it's a big, you know, summertime, there's like 50 guests and 80 students, and there's lots of meals being cooked every day. It's a professional kitchen, you know, gotta get moving. But that was his aspiration and practice, was to be quiet with the pots and pans. But you know, it would just take another moment. You know, each time you're going to, you know, put the pot in the sink to just do it so it doesn't make noise. Cleaning and storing tools. That's one thing that, I don't know, Zen Mountain Monastery, you know, the bell rings. Whenever the bell rings, you put your work down immediately, wherever you are. Sometimes you get a warning bell and then you finish up. But generally speaking, that when that bell ends, you put the task down, but then you take your tools and you clean them and you store them. And it was described to me as if you were never coming back once again. So there's that kind of reminder of impermanence again, as if I'm never going to come back to this task. So I will leave it there. Some time for a couple of questions if people want to talk about this.
I just wanted to know, what's the book, the Ramana, the small book there? Yes, that one.
The Origins of Buddhist Monastic Codes in China. One of my podcast research books.
Thank you for the reminder, because I started getting back into this. Like yesterday, I was chopping vegetables, and I was really making a practice of being present as I was slicing them. But I've been discombobulated the past few months. I used to have a prayer that I'd say when I would do my teeth, or a prayer when I was using water for washing. I divested myself, as in just gave away everything that I had in my kitchen. And so there's nothing left to cook or eat with. I've been collecting little plastic containers that people have from their salads. Like, I got one from Jim's not here. We were at Mark's. I said, go, can I have your plastic container? So they just had us a bowl. But then someone gifted me, there was a sale at, there just happened to be this salvage item, like these pots and pans, whole set that normally would have been like $200 for $40. And so it's a practice for me that I'm very diligent about cleaning them, and they are still looking like brand new. And that's one of my intentions when I use them. I'm using them more respectfully than I ever used a pot before.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just really cherishing them because this is, they're very special. They're just pots and pans, but no, they're not. But just to remind me again of, oh yeah, remember the toothbrush prayer, prayer when you brush your teeth and praying to Kuan Yin when I'm using water, thanking her for the water, whether it's in the kitchen or if it's in the bathroom. And the upshot of that was that my life seemed to have more sweetness to it. Mm. That's not what I was aiming for or doing it for. It's just that I was in the, and just seemed to have more presence, just in and of itself, or just when I opened the door, any door of this room would say thank you or welcome. And so I thank you for this because I need to be less discombobulated than I've been the past few months.
Well, that's the great thing about practice is that we wander away from it and it's there for us to return to when we remember. And yeah.
I had an experience just on my way here tonight. This talk kind of reminded me of. There was a little fly that was just above my dashboard. And without even thinking, I just swatted at it, right? I thought of it, I'm like, oh. You know, I had this sort of flippancy and this habitual just like killing of this living thing, you know, like it wasn't worth anything.
Yeah.
And so it brought me into this place like, wow, maybe I should bring more presence to these moments, right? But I got another opportunity because I didn't actually get him. And he was, you know, back on the windshield, and then I just opened my window and guided him out. And
yeah.
I was at it. It felt much better.
Yeah.
But it's just the idea that you can just, if you're not paying attention, then, you know, you can just easily have these motions without realizing the impact that you're having. So.
Yeah.
One of the things I like very much about what you said, that we've taken it in, I'm a very cerebral person, and the idea from a neuroplasticity point of view, building neural pathway, is that the body is really very engaged in all this and doing these things, building neural pathways of learning, as opposed to sitting with all this thinking going on and all the stuff that goes on, but to engage the body in it with all these, being careful about what you do, not leaving somebody else to do, wash your dish, whatever. It's really it's something that I have to work on always, because I'm just so engaged in my mind all the time.
Well, and it's interesting because I think the key to some of these practices is that it doesn't really matter how you feel about them or how you think about them. I mean, it's nice. It's nice if you feel something special when you put something down with both hands, but I don't know. Sometimes I think practice is really what's happening when you just turn the sound off, meaning our internal, what we're saying and what we're thinking, you know, our internal narrative. You turn that off and you just watch. You just could watch yourself. What's happening there? And if we make a habit of taking care of things or looking around us and noticing that, you know, there's somebody that was waiting and, you know, should they go first in line or, you know, just kind of consideration, care and attentiveness, that's I don't know. It's not just that it transforms our mind. It's that is our life practice.
When we were having tea earlier, we were talking about different books I was reading or teachers I was reading, and I mentioned that I had been reading some of the essays on the Andology website from MUHO.
Uh-huh.
And he describes it as disappearing into the action or becoming the action.
Mm. Well, and I do that sometimes, like when I'm, there's so, bowing, the simple act of bowing, kind of so many different, can feel so many different ways. And it's almost like, I mean, obviously we can do it just kind of, you know, in a rote way and whatever, we're not even really there, kind of, that's not quite right. And then bowing and feeling like, oh, this is so special. And sometimes I get it just right, and I'm just bowing. I'm just physically bowing.
Which is what I do at home.
And just doing it.
At home, when you talk about flipping the zafu and all, I think it's really kind of funny because I have always had a bit of social anxiety, and so with my home practice, I do all this, and I come here and I forget that.
I saw her, I went to see a monk years ago, I remember this, and I wanted to talk to him about high metaphysics and what's life all about and all that kind of stuff, and we were walking down the street, and as we were walking, and I was all in my head about, you know, whatever I was thinking, Dharma Kai, or this and that. I don't know what I was thinking about. And he, we were walking, and he saw on the ground, someone had dropped a bologna sandwich and white bread with a plastic bag in it. Someone dropped it, and it was there. And as we were talking, he stopped and picked up the baggie with the, and we walked further, and he put it in the garbage. And I missed that whole thing. And I realized that was it. And I missed it. I really, months later, I said, oh, that's what it was about. Because I wanted to talk about the intricacies of some Japanese word, or I don't know what I had in mind. But that's, I think, what we're talking about here is just getting really engaged.
You saw it on some level.
What?
You observed him doing that, though.
Oh, we stopped, and he was just picking it up, and he kept talking to me, and I was lost in my thoughts, and I was watching him do it, and I thought, well, what's this all about? And then we dropped it in the garbage, and then later on, when I really started thinking about it, I thought, well, that's what I came to talk, that's what that was about. And I missed it in that sense.
Well,
Chris?
Yeah?
Just when you mentioned the card about seeing everything as Buddha, remember one thing Chosen said? Your car is Buddha. The metal that makes your car, or the plastic, or the steering wheel. So every time you're doing anything in your car, you're turning the radio, that's all Buddha. That one was hard for me to wrap my head around, because my car is Buddha, but it's Buddha. And everything that went to make it to become a car. So we're all driving home in Buddha chariots.
Except that it pollutes everything.
Just to remember, but that's where I was before here. If we had to make sure everything was in order, and we'd sweep our own, pad, and then we'd bow three times at the altar, and then we'd have a ritual of a saying, and that we repeat together. But and then we'd pick up things on the floor, like lint. Yeah.
It takes a while to just get that, to get that culture going. I haven't been very good about it. And maybe we need a wrapping up process, because the thing is, one of the tricky things is we have classes and stuff in here, so it would be pretty natural if we did that at the end of Zazen and then we went somewhere else for class. But we kind of come back in here and then we kind of, you know, chat and mill around and stuff. So it's a little more...
We would do the three vows, you know.
End the night. So would you have like a talk and a class kind of thing, and then wrap it up with that?
At the closure, we'd do bow three times and get down. Yeah.
Get down.
Get down. Not really, yes.
Yeah, well, that might be worth adding, especially if we change the schedule a little bit so that we sit for a half an hour, and then we have our break, and then from 7 to 8, we have for the coming back in here and announcements and discussion and stuff, and then there'd be a little time for that. But tonight we could do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't have to do a chant, but just...
Did you come in and straighten us all up?
Well, no, the shuso helps, and people who are assigned to close, but really, you know, what I would recommend is just everybody straighten a few things.
Yes.
And those, you know, the chairs get evened out.
Right.
And,
like,
you know, the little card gets put into the middle of the cushion, and the bench or the zafu gets put in the middle, and... So everything just looks, so it's a practice that, you know, people can do, just chip in.
Yes.
What at the end of the night.
Sitting?
So the next sitting is Thursday. So when they come in on Thursday.
It'll be all.
But it's always in the center. If I'm
huh?
Keep the cushions in the center of the mat?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So
I do it, my cushion, always set it back in the position and I'll sit next.
Yeah.
To the edge of the. Back to the
I do that at home too, but yeah, here we just do it right in the middle.
Are we going to sweep the pad?
If you see one that needs it, by all means.
Just sitting on it, I think we felt that it had to be totally.
I mean, I brush mine off every time.
There we go.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.